The fight over voting rights and what it means for us.
Despite the fact that the Voting Rights Act was upheld as constitutional, what we see is that opponents of the law never stopped fighting. Just basically, opposition to the Voting Rights Act never ended.
That's Ari Berman. We talk with him about the Voting Rights Act, the backlash against it, and what it all means now. His book is Give Us the Ballot. Then, a new report says not only can electronic voting machines be hacked, they already have.
One thing that we mention in the report is what we call an environment of corruption. What we found was that there were quite a number of different ways that the vote was being suppressed.
That's Lulu Freisdat, co-author of the report, An Electoral System in Crisis. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In 2013, the Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. The decision weakened the Act's ability to prevent discriminatory practices against voters, especially voters of color. It was a victory for those who've been fighting to gut the Voting Rights Act since its enactment in 1967. At that time, Ari Berman of The Nation magazine had been covering Republican efforts to change the voting laws following the 2011 elections, laws that had been shown to suppress access to the ballot, especially by voters of color and students. They tend to vote Democratic. His search to uncover what led from the passage of the Act in 1967 to its enfeebling in 2013 resulted in his award-winning book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It's a fascinating history that holds critical lessons for us as we approach the 2016 presidential election. Well, Ari Berman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Give Us a Ballot. This book is about the modern struggle for voting rights in America. Where does the title Give Us a Ballot come from?
It comes from the first major speech that Martin Luther King gave about voting rights in May of 1957 when he was just 26 years old, which was called Give Us the Ballot. It was a gathering called the Prayer Pilgrimage for Freedom that took place at the Lincoln Memorial. In many ways, this was the precursor to the March on Washington, which came 6 years later. And King gave this speech, Give Us the Ballot, because this was the third anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision that desegregated public schools, but 3 years after the Brown decision, no schools in the South had desegregated. And that was because the South was still controlled by white Southern segregationists politically. And so what King was saying in his speech was that African Americans and others had to gain the right to vote to be able to change the political dynamics of the South and elsewhere so that schools would begin to integrate. And really, that was the only way the country was going to begin to change.
And this book comes at a very apt time. It's a time when voting rights, indeed the Voting Rights Act itself, are increasingly under attack. Although recently there has been some pushback, talk a little bit about how this current struggle informed how you looked at the struggle back in the 1960s for voting rights.
So most people who write histories start at the beginning and then work their way forwards. And I actually did the opposite. I started really in the present day and then worked my way backwards. And the way that I came to cover the issue of voting rights was in early 2011, I noticed following the 2010 elections that many states were changing their voting laws to make it more difficult to vote. Republicans had just captured a very large legislative majorities in states across the country following the 2010 election, and they swiftly introduced all of these different measures to make it harder to vote, whether it was requiring strict ID to cast a ballot or cutting back on early voting or making it harder to register to vote. And I noticed that this was happening in a lot of really important swing states, places like Florida and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio. And it seemed to me the beginning of a very disturbing national trend. And so I covered that first for Rolling Stone and then for The Nation magazine. And then I got much more interested in the history of the Voting Rights Act. And in early 2013, following the 2012 election, the Supreme Court heard a challenge to the Voting Rights Act. And it was at that point that I began to ask many people what I should really read to get up to speed on what the Voting Rights Act did. Why was it being challenged? What it had accomplished? All of those things. And I was surprised that no one had really written a comprehensive account of the Voting Rights Act. There had been so much written about the events that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act, whether it was the marches in Selma or the protests in Mississippi, but there had been far less written about what happened after the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And so really that's how I became interested in the history and trying to connect the struggles of the modern day to the struggles of the 1960s.
Well, let's go back to that first struggle for voting rights during the civil rights era. It was centered on voter registration at first. What conditions faced black voters who wanted to vote in states like Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and the other southern states?
Well, before the passage of the Voting Rights Act, it was incredibly dangerous for African Americans to even try to register to vote. As we know, people were killed in places like Mississippi for trying to register voters. And in some southern states, very, very few people were able to register. In Mississippi, for example, only 6.7% of African Americans were registered to vote. In certain counties in Mississippi and Alabama, that number was much, much lower. In Selma, Alabama, which became the focal point of the protests for the Voting Rights Act, only 2% of African Americans were registered to vote. In the county next door to Selma, Alabama, Lowndes County, which was 80% African American, there wasn't a single black registered voter. And that was done through a variety of means. There were things like literacy tests and poll taxes that prevented African Americans from registering, but there were also things like in Lowndes County, if you were black, you needed a white person to vouch for you to register, which no white person would do. Or if you registered to vote, they would print your name in the newspaper so everyone would know, and your address, so everyone would know where you live, so that you could face great physical danger. So there were both official means and then unofficial means that prevented African Americans from being able to register. And the Voting Rights Act is what got rid of that. It both legally got rid of those things and also eliminated the climate of fear that surrounded voter registration.
So give us just a brief summary of how that act came to be. You know, it has a number of different sections to it, and I'd like you to explain first Section 5 and then Section 2.
Sure. So basically, the problem that the Voting Rights Act was designed to solve was the problem of how few African Americans were registered to vote in the segregated South. And so the Voting Rights Act got rid of that problem, solved that problem, first by striking down all of the official devices that had prevented African Americans from registering. So it struck down things like literacy tests that had been used unfairly to prevent African Americans from registering. Then it sent federal officials down to the South just days after the law passed to register voters. So this wasn't some abstract thing where people just suddenly got the right to vote. This was something where people actually showed up in places like Selma, Alabama, where it had been extremely dangerous to try to register. And they registered hundreds of people in days and then, you know, thousands of people within weeks. And so that had a really powerful impact. And then what happened over a longer period of time was that the Voting Rights Act said that those states with the longest histories of voting discrimination had to approve their voting changes with the federal government to make sure they didn't discriminate in the future. And that's what became known as Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And that part of the law was incredibly important because the drafters of the Voting Rights Act realized that once certain literacy tests and things like that were struck down, states like Alabama and Mississippi were going to think of more ingenious ways to try to restrict voting rights. And indeed, that's precisely what happened. That Mississippi, for example, held a special legislative session in 1966 and passed 13 different election laws to make it harder for newly registered black voters to be able to run for office, to be able to be elected, to be able to have real representation. And so the next step, the next phase of the battle over the Voting Rights Act was about representation. Once people got registered, would they actually have a political voice? And so that part of the Voting Rights Act was incredibly important. And then the other part of the Voting Rights Act was Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And the difference was that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was targeted at certain states. It required what became known as preclearance for voting changes, federal approval for all voting changes, and it was temporary. That part of the law had to be renewed by Congress. Section 2, on the other hand, was national in scope. It didn't have to be renewed. But the difference was is that it didn't block laws before they took into effect. It only could be used to challenge laws after they were passed and often after they were put into effect. And so that part of the Voting Rights Act didn't become important till a few decades later.
Right, and we'll get back to that. But first, it wasn't just the South that came under Section 5. There were parts of New York, as a matter of fact, as well.
Yeah, so it focused, I would say, largely on the South, but not exclusively, because there were other places. For example, like you mentioned, there were three counties in New York, Brooklyn, Manhattan, and the Bronx, that had English-only literacy tests beginning in 1924 that weren't abolished until the 1960s, that were aimed at disenfranchising different immigrant groups, like Puerto Ricans, for example. And so parts of New York were covered, parts of Arizona were covered, parts of California were covered, and the Voting Rights Act was expanded in 1965 to include discrimination against language minority groups. So Hispanics, Asian Americans, Native Americans, they received protection as well. And that led to the Voting Rights Act covering Texas, for example, and also parts of other states that had discrimination against not just African Americans, but language minority groups as well. And that really expanded the scope of the Voting Rights Act.
Brooklyn is famous most recently for the purge of 125,000 voters from the rolls. Is this a more recent thing, voter purging, or has voter purging been going on for a very long time?
Voter purging has been going on for a very long time. I mean, there's been a variety of ways in which people restrict the right to vote. And I tell the story in the book about how there was an election in one county in Alabama, a majority black county in which African Americans were going to be able to gain political control for the first time. And many people were aligned with a third party there because both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party were still official segregationist elements, even in the late 1960s. And after all these new voters had been registered with a third party, they showed up on election day and their names just weren't on the voting rolls. They just weren't registered. And the Supreme Court sent a notice that said, you have to put these people on the voter rolls. They were legitimately registered. And the county registrar just ignored the Supreme Court's notice, which is something that was even bizarre by the standards of Southern segregationists. So, I mean, even after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, you saw these kind of things happen. And that eventually got resolved. Eventually, the Supreme Court did say that the county registrar had to enforce the law. People's names were added to the voting rolls. Black candidates were elected for the first time. But this just shows the extraordinary length that people have gone to try to manipulate the voting rolls, to try to control voter registration so that people can't have political power.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ari Berman about his book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Now, after the Voting Rights Act, the backlash did not take long to begin to gather steam. Give us some of the highlights, not current ones, because we'll talk about them in a little bit, but give us some of the highlights over time of the effort to undo the Voting Rights Act.
Well, within days after the Voting Rights Act was passed, Southern segregationists like Alabama Governor George Wallace were already trying to figure out how to challenge the law. And basically what they said is they told local registrars not to register black voters, and then they challenged the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act in an 8-1 decision. In 1966, a year after the Voting Rights Act was passed, and the decision actually came on the one-year anniversary of the Bloody Sunday protests in Selma, Alabama. But despite the fact that the Voting Rights Act was upheld as constitutional, what we see is that opponents of the law never stopped fighting it. They kept trying to find new and ingenious ways to challenge the law, to challenge the constitutionality of the law, to challenge the law in Congress, to challenge the law through the executive branch. That just basically opposition to the Voting Rights Act never ended.
And one of the ways they did that was by criticizing the regional nature of Section 5. And they argued that it should be nationalized. The Voting Rights Act should apply equally everywhere. Why would nationalizing the Voting Rights Act actually weaken it?
Well, basically, the biggest problems when it came to voting rights in the 1960s were in the South, and so that's where the Voting Rights Act was focused. It didn't mean that other places didn't have problems, but it meant that states in the South, like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, had problems that were much, much deeper and more intractable than in other parts of the country, and far more people were disenfranchised in those areas. And so only those areas needed to have to approve their voting changes with the federal government, and that there wasn't a need, for example, for other states to have to do that. And so when the Voting Rights Act was nationalized, when it was proposed to nationalize it, that was done as a way to try to make it unconstitutional, because the courts upheld this one part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, precisely because it was targeted at the worst actors. And when the Nixon administration first proposed nationalizing the law, you had members of Congress who said, this is like trying to build a dam in Idaho because there's a flood in Mississippi, that the Voting Rights Act had provisions, as we discussed earlier, that were national in scope, but the specific part of the Voting Rights Act that required federal approval for all voting changes was targeted mostly at the South, because that's where the biggest problems are, and there really wasn't either a constitutional reason to make every state approve its voting changes, but there also just wasn't, practically speaking, the ability for the Justice Department or the federal courts to be able to review voting changes in all 50 states. I mean, it was a lot of work to do this in 16 states, let alone try to do it in all 50 when there wasn't a need.
When the backlash against the Voting Rights Act ramped up in the 70s and 80s, we saw the use of code words like states' rights and the use of the voter fraud claim, which we're hearing about all the time right now. Talk about this notion of voter fraud.
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting because you heard voter fraud being brought up when the Voting Rights Act was passed. You heard people like segregationist sheriffs who said, well, now we're going to have all these illiterate black voters illegitimately voting. I mean, so that's not a new argument. Indeed, arguments about voter fraud go back to Reconstruction, when black citizens got the right to vote for the first time in the South. And so it's not a new argument. In some ways, voter fraud has always been a code word. There was actually a lot more voter fraud, quite frankly, back then than there is now. It was usually done by white people, quite honestly. If you think about Tammany Hall in New York City, I mean, that was basically an all-white operation that was committing the most voter fraud. But when it came to the South, certainly voter fraud was something that basically was a code word for too many black people voting. And I think that is a movement that has evolved and become more sophisticated over time.
I wonder if you could talk about how the fight against affirmative action led to the attack on the Voting Rights Act.
So this is that's a really good point. Basically, opponents of the Voting Rights Act began to really embrace what became known as colorblind arguments. So essentially, the idea that anything that was used to remedy discrimination that supposedly gave preferential treatment to one group or another had become as bad as the original crime. So basically, there were a lot of people who opposed affirmative action who felt like African Americans and other minorities were getting preferential treatment, and they begin to make the same argument about the Voting Rights Act. Because one of the things that the Voting Rights Act said was that, for example, if you could draw a district that would allow the first African American or the first Hispanic or the first Asian American to be elected, that you should try to do that. And because really, these groups had absolutely no representation before the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And so there needed to be attempts to give representation to underrepresented communities, and that the Voting Rights Act was going to be one tool to do that. But nonetheless, that provoked a really big backlash, and there were arguments that basically said that, you know, anytime there was a district that was a majority Black district or a majority Hispanic district or a majority Asian American district, that that violated quote unquote color blindness. And this was an argument that you began to hear a lot in the late 70s and early 80s by conservatives, including people that were formerly liberal who then identified as more conservative.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking about the Voting Rights Act and the backlash against it with Ari Berman. His book is Give Us the Ballot. In fact, there was one figure, Abigail Thernstrom, who who really brought this argument forward. Very curious case. Talk a little bit about her and how instrumental her work was in the over recent 5-4 ruling of the Supreme Court that gutted Section 5 of the bill.
Well, Abigail Thernstrom was someone who was at Harvard University and along with her husband was very influential. It basically was someone who had formerly liberal beliefs and then really had a strong reaction against affirmative action and basically said that the Voting Rights Act was leading to affirmative action in the electoral sphere. And her arguments proved very influential with the Reagan administration in the 1980s, who had embraced this colorblind or this reactionary colorblind argument. And that really led to a whole new generation of people embracing these kind of ideas, whether it was Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas or Chief Justice Roberts, that basically the entire conservative legal establishment came to view the Voting Rights Act not as something that had remedied historic discrimination, but that something that indeed was discriminatory itself. And so that was a different argument than the sort of classic states' rights argument that had been used against the Voting Rights Act. And that proved to be very influential in conservative circles.
Now, finally, there is a pushback that is beginning to develop, I think, against the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. Talk about how Section 2 is being used to push back against the Supreme Court ruling that gutted Section 5, and how effective do you think it'll be?
So what the Supreme Court said in 2013 was that those states with the longest histories of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. They didn't strike down that requirement, but they struck down the formula under which those states were covered, so no states were then subject to the federal approval requirement. And so what happened after that is both civil rights groups and the federal government are using a different part of the Voting Rights Act to try to validate discriminatory laws in places like North Carolina. And they've had some success in doing so. Laws like North Carolina's law, which didn't just require strict ID, but cut back on early voting and made it harder to register to vote and did all these other things, that was struck down recently by the federal courts. The problem is that in states like North Carolina, before the Voting Rights Act was gutted, these laws would have been blocked before they even took effect. And not only that, but the burden of proof would have been on the states themselves to prove that the law was not discriminatory. So that was a major burden that the states had to move to be able to get these laws through. And so that's why Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was so effective. In Section 2, you can still win these cases, but only after the laws have gone into effect, only after years of very expensive litigation, and often only after people have already been disenfranchised, because that's evidence at many of these trials. And so I think that what we're seeing is there has been some success in using the existing provisions of the Voting Rights Act, but it's a lot more difficult than it was before. And there just is not nearly as much protection as there was before. And so I still think that we're seeing lots of places where new voting restrictions are allowed to go through, and the courts are pushing back, but usually only in the most extreme circumstances, where states like Texas and North Carolina have just gone much too far for both conservative and liberal justices. But I don't think we're in a situation right now where people feel like they have all the voting rights protections they need.
And so what do you think it's going to take?
Well, I think it's going to take a different political dynamics, quite frankly. I think as long as Republicans are in control of Congress, nothing is going to happen. And I think as long as Republicans are in control of so many states, it can be very difficult to get the laws to change. And so I think on one hand, just changing the political dynamics is really important. The Supreme Court said, for example, that Congress could draw a new formula for the Voting Rights Act, could draw a more modern formula. So they have the power to do this. The problem is not that they don't have the power to do so. The problem is that they haven't had the political will to actually do anything. And so I think that we could see the Congress act. We could see states adopt more progressive policies. Some states are already doing that. States like Oregon right now, you have automatic voter registration. When you go to the DMV and you get a driver's license, you're automatically registered to vote, which could be the wave of the future in a bunch of different states. And so there are things that are being done on a more progressive level, but I think as long as conservative Republicans are in control of so many places, it's going to be difficult to make progress on voting rights.
And I suppose that then comes back to my point about election integrity, because if you cannot guarantee the ballot, the integrity of the ballot, then, it really depends on who's able to steal the election more competently than the other party. And there have been a lot of indications that, in fact, the Republicans have been at the forefront of some of these machinations around hacking voting machines, controlling voting machines, and even getting into databases to control the, to do vast voter purges. So I wonder if you think maybe we might need to move from an exclusive focus on the kind of registration, the kind of struggle that you've been talking about, to a broader look at making sure our elections are honest in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're starting to see that happening already. I mean, you're starting to see a lot more concern about voting machines, a lot more concern about hacking, given everything that's gone on so far with hacking in this campaign. So I think you're starting to see a broader look at our voting system and writ large and all the problems that there are with it.
Well, Ari Berman, this is just a terrific book and a terrific read as well. Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ari Berman writes for The Nation magazine. Give Us the Ballot was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, an analysis of the 2016 primaries has some disturbing conclusions. Stay tuned after the break.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Lurleen Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama has got me so upset, and Memphis has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Americans are worried about their democracy. Voters across the political spectrum are afraid the 2016 general election will be rigged. While fears about voter fraud have been trumped up by the right, as we heard in today's first segment, Democratic, third-party, and independent voters are worried about election fraud, especially hacking of electronic voting machines and voter databases. They're afraid their votes won't count, or that they'll find their registrations have mysteriously disappeared on Election Day. Well, they might be right. A rigorous new analysis of the 2016 primaries has found serious statistical anomalies in primary after primary that suggest widespread rigging of electronic voting machines. My guest, Lulu Freistadt, co-author of the report An Electoral System in Crisis, says the anomalies were so widespread they could have changed the outcome of the Democratic primary. The Republican primary was also affected, but not as much. The other major Western democracies have largely rejected electronic voting machines to count their votes by hand. Freistadt says if Americans are to be sure their vote is counted correctly, we need to do the same. Well, Lulu Freistadt, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, this report, An Election System in Crisis, tell us a little bit about how you and your collaborators came together to do this.
Well, I've been studying the dysfunction of our elections for almost 10 years. I put out a documentary in 2008 called Holler Back, Not Voting in an American Town. And that was an exploration of the systemic problems with our elections that discourage participation. And what I mean by that is ways that are built into the system that basically make it so that people don't want to participate or that it's very challenging for people to participate. And one of the reasons that I found recurring on a regular basis when I talked to people who didn't participate was that they were concerned that the votes weren't being counted correctly. They didn't believe the totals. And so as part of the film, we investigated that. And I filmed some grad students at Princeton hacking one of the electronic voting machines. And at that time, I became aware of how vulnerable they are, how easy they are to hack, and how likely it is that the results could be manipulated. And so since that time, I've spent a lot of my time following the issue, reading other research that people have done, and continuing my own research. So this year, I wanted to have something that was more definitive, something that was more than just a guess as to whether or not the elections were being manipulated. And I looked into some statistical methods that were being used, and I wanted to verify if they were accurate and if they could identify actual manipulation. And the answer to those questions we found in our research was yes, those studies were accurate, and yes, they could identify what in all likelihood is manipulation of our election results.
So you have some pretty heavy hitters on your team in terms of statistical expertise.
We worked in collaboration with Dr. Fritz Schurin, who was a former president of the American Statistical Association, a vice president at NORC, which has done a lot of research in regard to statistics. Dr. Schurin is a professor of statistics at the George Washington University. And his position on the team was to really look at the research we were doing and vet it. And he would ask questions and really try to determine if the results we were coming up with were solid. And his conclusion was that they were very solid indeed. And he wound up saying that the election results were suspicious. That was the word that he used. And my co-author on the project is a very talented statistician named Anselmo Sampietro. And he just brought a tremendous amount of skill and just some dedication to the project. And his work is very strong, and it was replicated by another analyst. So all of the work that we've put out has been checked by two different analysts who came up with identical results.
And now to those results. You state in the beginning of the report that research provides convincing evidence that electronic voting equipment is not counting the votes accurately. Why is electronic voting equipment so vulnerable?
There's just so many different ways that you can hack it, and there's a lot of articles coming out now that show how it can be manipulated. So one possibility is that the totals could be adjusted through central tabulation, so that even if you have paper ballots like that are being counted in an optical scan machine, those results usually get counted centrally, and it's possible that's done on computers, and so those results could be changed at that point in the process. And one thing that we're finding is that expert after expert is saying that this is a very definite possibility. So, for example, there's a new article out by Richard Clark, who's a security expert who's advised three different presidents. And what he says there is, if it's a computer, it can be hacked. So there's other hacks that have been done spreading viruses from machine to machine. There's hacks that have been done by inserting a different panel behind the front panel. There's hacks that have been done from a distance, attacking the machine remotely and gaining control of the entire system. That's what was done in the voting demo in Washington, D.C. that J. Alex Halderman hacked, where within, I think, 36 hours, they had control of the entire system. They not only had control of the voting system, they had control of the video cameras that were observing the voting system. They were able to change all of the voter totals. And in the end, they were able to play the University of Michigan fight song after the voter finished voting. That's how vulnerable these machines are. Every single aspect of them can be hacked.
And it isn't just the machines. While you focus on the vulnerability of electronic voting machines, you also say that a U.S. federal report found that the U.S. voter database was hacked. If someone can hack the U.S. voter database, what could they do to influence an election?
Well, the voter database is the information that stores all of our data about our voters. So if you can attack that, you could, for one thing, just start eliminating who is considered a registered voter. And right there, you could affect the election. That's a very simple thing that you could do. And there's evidence that that sort of tampering was done in the 2016 election. There were many people who had their registration changed, which seems like a small thing to do. You change someone from a Democrat to an independent or from a Republican to a Democrat. But because it's a primary, if that person's registration has been changed, voila, they can't vote in the primary because they have to be registered for the correct party. So there's all kinds of ways that data can be manipulated to affect the outcome of the election.
Now, you analyze not just the 2016 primary, which we'll get to later, but you also analyze five presidential cycles, as well as off-year races, from across the country. What did you find?
We found that in races prior to, say, 2004, when we looked at the elections from 2000, we didn't see statistical irregularities. We saw very straightforward statistical patterns that follow a mathematical principle called the law of large numbers. And what that means is that the candidates would hit an average percentage and they would stay there in the small precincts and the large precincts. And that's a statistically normal pattern. That's what we would expect. But when we looked at elections starting at least by 2008, we saw some very different statistical patterns that were not statistically regular. They did not follow the law of large numbers, and they were statistically improbable and irregular. And in particular, we find that as the precinct size gets larger, certain candidates will increase their percentage and other candidates will decrease their percentage. And there's really no explanation for that, no plausible explanation that we could find, not through demographics and not through error, because these are very consistent patterns. They don't look like errors. And because we're seeing those patterns come into play after the introduction of electronic voting equipment, it is certainly a possibility that it is the electronic voting equipment that is responsible for these irregular statistical patterns.
What is the significance? I mean, many people have said, well, you know, larger precincts are just demographically different. And you just said, well, the democratic patterns don't account for it. But I wonder if you could drill down a little bit into that and explain why demographics doesn't explain this discrepancy.
There's two reasons why we don't feel that there is a demographic explanation for the statistical irregularities that we're seeing. One is because the numbers are just too large for demographic explanation. So, for example, in a state like Louisiana, we had a 36% difference between the votes that were reported, the reported totals, and what we would consider a statistically normal pattern. And when you look at possible demographic explanations, people were saying, for example, that it could be due to race, that maybe there's a higher percentage of African Americans in the large precincts. And when you look at the percentage of African Americans in the total population, there was only 30 to 31% total African Americans in the populations of the counties we were looking at. So if you have 30% African American population, even if all of them vote for one candidate, that is not going to explain a 36% variation from a normal pattern. So that's one reason. The demographics were not large enough to explain the variations that we were seeing. And this was in multiple states. We also saw variations in Alabama of approximately 28%. We saw variations across the country that varied from, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10% in state after state after state. So the other reason that we did not feel that demographics was a reasonable explanation was because there was no single demographic pattern that could explain these statistical irregularities showing up in Wisconsin and in Alabama, for example. Those are very different demographics. Do you know why? So the fact that we were seeing the irregular patterns occur in state after state after state reinforced the fact that it was very hard for there to be a demographic explanation for that.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with journalist and documentarian Lulu Freisdet about her report, An Electoral System in Crisis. Now, you're talking about the 2016 Democratic primary in this case. Is that correct?
It is. And we also saw variations from the normal statistical patterns in the Republican primary as well. So this was on both sides, although the variations in the Democratic primary were certainly much larger than the Republican primary. We were concerned about the irregular patterns on the Republican side, but we did not think that they were large enough to change the outcome of the election. Whereas with the Democratic primary in the 2016 race, these were differences from a statistically expected pattern that were potentially large enough to change the outcome.
So now you're talking about these statistical irregularities are showing up in the machine counts, and you were able to contrast them with the hand-counted ballots. Is that correct?
That is correct. We looked at hand-counted precincts in Wisconsin and also one hand-counted precinct in Columbia County, New York. And those precincts always showed what we considered a statistically expected pattern. That is, those patterns, the results from those elections followed the law of large numbers. Candidates had approximately the same percentage of support in the small and large precincts. And there was no variation, you know, that would make the results suspicious. Whereas when we compared those to machine counted precincts, there was a noticeable difference. For example, in Wisconsin, in the Republican race, Trump received 17% less support in the largest precincts in the machine counted races than he did in the hand counted races. So he saw his support plummet in the large precincts when the votes were counted by machine. But we did not see that happen in the hand-counted precincts. In the hand-counted precincts, his support stayed approximately the same, 51%, in the small and the large precincts. So we were concerned that we're having such different results from hand-counted precincts to machine-counted precincts. You're talking about Wisconsin, so you're talking about counties that are sitting right next door to each other and do not have large demographic differences.
You just said before that the difference in the Democratic 2016 primary was enough to potentially change the outcome of that election. How much of a difference did you find overall between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders around these statistical anomalies?
First off, these are estimates. And it's very hard to tell. Unfortunately, unless we actually count the votes by hand, we may never know what the actual support of these candidates was. The average percentage that we have estimated is 12.82%, so approximately 13% difference between the reported totals and the expected statistical pattern. And that is a difference that could have brought the race to within approximately 74,000 votes. If you count the 13% difference in the machine counts. And then in addition to that, Sanders had also accumulated about 130,000 votes through the caucus system that would have brought Hillary Clinton's lead down to approximately 74,000 votes. And keeping in mind that these are estimates, that's certainly enough that it could have changed the outcome. That turns what, you know, what people considered a Hillary Clinton decisive victory into basically a neck and neck race where things like the candidate's momentum in different states could really start to affect the outcome. Or you might have gone into the convention with a, you know, much more contested race. So this is something that Dr. Shuren confirmed as well in his work with us. He said point blank that it would have been much closer and it's possible that Sanders could have won.
Now, that doesn't take into account the many reports of votes not counted, especially with the provisional ballots. And that could be in the millions in California. And in New York, like in Brooklyn, where there were 120,000 voters purged, of those 120,000 provisional ballots cast, only 30,000 were counted. Talk about the voter purges and how that might have also influenced the election.
One thing that we mention in the report is what we call an environment of corruption. What we found was that there were quite a number of different ways that the vote was being suppressed, and that included voters' registrations being changed without their knowledge or intent, voters being sent incorrect ballots, a shortage of ballots at the polls, polling places being closed, discouraging long lines in targeted precincts and states. There were case after case after case where people came forward and said, you know, for one reason or another, I was not allowed to vote, whether they were purged from the rolls, whether their registration was changed. And the reason why we found this to be significant is that if there is some kind of fraud in play in these more traditional parts of the election, it does make it more likely that fraud could be at play in other parts of the election, like the electronic voting machines, which is more what we're talking about.
You've been talking about the statistical anomalies. You actually name the method of analysis that you used. Tell us what a cumulative precinct vote tally chart is.
That's the method that was developed to help detect this statistical irregularity where the candidates are receiving different levels of support in the small and the large precincts. So one of the things that we do in the paper is we discuss how this method was developed, and we spend some time testing its accuracy and its reliability. It was not developed in the mainstream statistical community. It was developed by analysts who were online in forums. Initially, it was developed by people who were supporting Ron Paul in 2012. And they were very concerned that Ron Paul's results looked unusual. And so they developed a technique to try to determine what was unusual about Ron Paul's results. And one of the things that they came up with, and in particular, there was an engineer called Phil Evans who designed this technique. He figured out that Ron Paul's results were getting exponentially smaller in the large precincts, and that was happening in a mathematically precise way. And he did some experimenting with different algorithms, and he started to be convinced that this was some sort of manipulation. He did not think it looked like a normal pattern. Now, at that time in 2012, this method, which now we call the CVT method, was not really given much thought. It wasn't developed by academic statisticians, and people didn't really take it seriously. But one of the things that I did with my research was that I got academic statisticians to test it and replicate it and investigate its accuracy. And we found that it was accurate. It was replicated successfully by a team at Berkeley, as well as there was research done by Beth Clarkson. Even before I started my research, Beth Clarkson is a established statistician. She has a PhD in statistics and works with an aeronautics agency. And Beth actually was one of the first academic statisticians to test this CVT method. And one of the things that Beth said about it that she likes, she says that voting data is what she calls a noisy data set. That means there's a lot of, you know, there's votes all over the place, and it's hard necessarily to find patterns. But she likes the CVT method because it eliminates a lot of the noise in the data set, and it makes it very clear to see this pattern. And what became clear when we graphed the results this way, and the way that we graph them is we start with the precincts with the smallest number of votes, and then we add them together cumulatively, precinct by precinct by precinct, until we finally add in the very largest precinct, so that you have from the left side of the graph to the right side of the graph a progression of the candidate's support from the smallest precincts to the largest precincts. And when you graph the results this way, it becomes quite clear that certain candidates are getting larger and larger amounts of support. Their percentages are rising as the precincts get larger. And another candidate, so in 2016, it was often Clinton and Sanders. Clinton's percentages would rise exponentially as the precincts got larger, and Sanders' percentages would plummet and go down as the precincts got larger. And this was the pattern that we found to be suspicious, and that Dr. Shuren also found to be suspicious.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with journalist and documentarian Lulu Freisdet about her report, An Electoral System in Crisis. So how could a machine be rigged to show up this pattern of greater vote discrepancy in the larger voter precincts?
Well, I mean, they may be. We don't know for sure. Obviously, this is a statistical analysis, so at this point, it's a theory, and we are, in fact, trying to figure it out. And we're also, our research is in progress, and we're actually doing some other research now that is, you know, sort of a whole new technique. So we are still trying to figure it out. But the best that we can figure is that, first off, you're going to get more bang for your buck if you're going to manipulate totals in large precincts. If you change, if you have, you know, 1,500 votes in one precinct and you adjust it by 2%, you're going to get a lot more extra votes than if you have a precinct with 15 votes and you adjust it by 2%. So there's definitely more opportunity in the large precincts. And the other factor to take into consideration is that there is a certain amount of risk involved in this. And if you manipulate results in very small precincts, you can get into situations where there may only be 20 votes in a precinct. And these are small communities who know each other. And all 20 of those people may know each other and know how they voted. So you really want to be careful that you don't wind up manipulating the vote in a way that it becomes quite obvious. So those are two reasons why, if someone was going to manipulate the elections, it might be more advantageous to manipulate large precincts and not small precincts.
A lot of people are saying these machines are vulnerable to being hacked, but 80% of Americans vote with paper ballots in OptiScan machines. Even though those machines can be manipulated, you still have the paper ballots. Can't they be audited for an accurate vote count? And wouldn't the chance of auditing discourage anyone who wanted to rig the election?
We could audit the elections, and it would be great if we were auditing the elections. But the fact of the matter is that, for all intent and purposes, we are not auditing the bulk of these elections. And these reports that say 60% of the elections are being audited are simply not based on what is actually happening. We researched this, and according to a website that tracks audits in every state, there are only 12 states that audit every candidate in every race and every issue on the ballot. And we found even that list of 12 states to be suspect, because one of the states listed was New York, and New York is not doing any kind of meaningful audits of its elections. So there are not meaningful audits taking place in the vast majority of these elections.
So what should we do?
We do strongly support hand-counted paper ballots. And what we mean by that is we would like to see A paper ballot that a voter marks themselves, like an optical scan ballot, you know, where you fill in a bubble or however you want to do it, that has clear voter intent and is very different from a piece of paper that a computer prints out. That is very different. And in that situation where a computer prints out a piece of paper, the voter's intent could be manipulated. And often people don't look at those pieces of paper. So that is not really a way to improve the security. So we're talking about paper ballots that voters mark themselves. And then if they are hand counted in a process that is open to the scrutiny of the public and the media and has secure chain of custody, meaning we know where those ballots are at all times, then we will have a process where we can really be confident that we know who won the election. And that is the process that is used in the vast majority of democracies internationally, especially in Europe. European democracies, by and large, count their ballots by hand, paper ballots that they count by hand.
But wouldn't it be too time-consuming and expensive to count all the votes by hand?
I don't think that we've had any real studies about how expensive it would be to count the votes by hand. If anything, I suspect that it would be much less expensive because this electronic equipment is very expensive. It costs millions and millions of dollars for counties to buy these machines, and then they require upkeep and maintenance contracts and software checks and security checks. The machines are a large expense, and the counties do not have the money to invest in new equipment. So what happens is we just keep using older equipment that's more and more vulnerable, not only to hacking, but also just to age and to wearing out. So the great advantage of hand counting your ballots is that you don't have to buy new equipment every few years. You train citizen volunteers, and there are plenty of people who want to volunteer for this and are eager to do it. And there are counties where they're doing this very successfully. So, for example, in Columbia County, New York, I spoke with the commissioner there, Virginia Martin, and she said they have a team. I think she said they have a team of about six volunteers who are very well trained now and come in. Some are Democrats, some are Republicans. And she said everybody is there to do a good job. They're not there with an agenda. They're there to count the votes and count them as accurately as possible. And they're very skilled now at doing this, and they count 100% of the ballots. And as far as I can tell, it hasn't been any extra expense for them. In fact, she said that it's been very affordable. And she's developed other ways there of saving money. One thing that she said is that they print the ballots themselves instead of sending them out to a printing company. And she said they save a lot of money on the ballots that way. So I think there's lots of ways that we can save money on our elections, but I don't think that we want to save that money in the counting process. That's really where we want to be as scrupulous as possible.
Right. What price democracy? And actually, we spoke with Virginia Martin, and we will link to that on our website, to that interview that we did. So finally, what's at stake here? The simple answer is, well, it's simply our democracy is at stake. But there are many people who really think it's unlikely. They have a hard time wrapping their mind around the idea that our elections are rigged.
I think it's very challenging for people to acknowledge this and for people to accept that it's quite possible that one of the things that we pride ourselves on the most, our democracy, is actually undergoing very serious challenges. But the best thing that we can do is to look this challenge in the face, just as we've looked any number of other challenges in the face, and tackle it head on and really try to come to terms with it. And luckily, this isn't something like climate change that would take millions and millions of dollars and all kinds of scientific inventions to help us tackle. This is something that we could really do in a relatively short period of time. If we decided as a nation to count the ballots by hand, we could implement this across the country. And the protocols are there. There are counties that have done this for years, and there's videos showing how to do it. This is such a solvable problem that I think the sooner that we can acknowledge that we have it and move on to the solution phase, the better. And I think there's a lot of people who really want to see us do that. And if you look at some of the reports coming out now, like this report from NORC and AP that reported that 9 in 10 Americans lack confidence in the country's political system, that is 90% of people. I mean, that is astounding. We really have to look at that and look for solutions and really improve. We can do better.
Lulu Freisdat. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to her report, An Electoral System in Crisis. You can also find a link to our interview with Board of Elections Supervisor in Columbia County, New York, Virginia Martin. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.